Hi, everybody. Five down, one to go. I want to thank a lot of people before Walt comes back and resumes his leadership. I want to thank Jackson in particular, who's and all the technical folks who really, without their assistance, none of this would happen. Tim, also want to thank you. And Michelle. Yeah, it's Michelle and Tim, a wonderful liturgist. The music, Paul, it's just both of you, just is wonderful. And I also want to, even though he's and that's an amen over here on the So this is going to be interesting. This is the last of the sessions, and it has to deal with the issue of fairness, God, and randomness. So I hope you're all in a position to be able to take a look at the slides, and I'll try to leave 10 or 15 minutes at the end. We're all familiar with the saying over and over again that life is not fair. We've heard it many, many times, or many of us have even asked, why me? And if you heard Paul Rasmussen this morning, he really was addressing this theme very much, is that sometimes what we perceive to be God's ways are not necessarily our own ways. And I'm going to try to address this issue. And what Michelle said is really true. I'm going to try to pull all this together as best we can and hopefully answer some questions and maybe open up a few more questions as well. So the question we start with is, why do we perceive life as being unfair? And I think the real reason is that deep down inside we all have a desire for consistency. It's one of our most basic traits is to seek consistency in all we do, in all the endeavors from start to finish. This is especially true in the area of fairness. I'm going to tie this back into the future topic that we talked about last week as well, because part of the future involves the issue of fairness, especially those of us who are in the faith, for peace and justice being two of the core values here. But we normally, when we think of fairness, we define it in terms of you get what you deserve in life. That's the way we think of life. But when I teach my philosophy classes and philosophy of religion and so on, and include philosophical thinking within the topics that I teach, it is clear to me that the issue of fairness is one of the most complicated issues out there. And sometimes it takes more than just a brief period of time to be able to explore all the nuances of it. And let's move ahead. Now, the ideal, of course, is that when people are good, they should be rewarded. This is the notion of fairness. And when they are bad, they should, in some sense, I don't know if the word punished is quite right, the word, but then nonetheless, that's the general sense we have. So when people work hard, they should reap the benefits, and when they do not, they should not. So in a perfect world, people should get what they are due. So I put some rewards and punishments up here. We've just gone through a series of Olympics. If you ski down the hill faster than anybody else, what's the color of your medal? It's gold, followed by silver, followed by bronze. People get what they deserve. Now, sometimes the whole team gets a medal. In this particular case, the second slide or vision image, second from the right, is a whole team holding the same trophy. Everybody benefits. If you study hard, as the other one indicates, you should eventually receive that diploma. And if you write a paper better than somebody else, you should get the high grade in the class. You should get the A, whereas we consider this to be fair. And over here, this gentleman on the right is holding a dollar bill that says bonus on it, if you can't see it. If you work hard in the office, frequently at the end of the year, the boss will give you a bonus, and everybody does not necessarily get the same bonus. Now, those are all rewards, and we just accept that, and we take that for granted. It's just part of the way we think of life. Now, if you rob a bank and you get caught, what happens? You go to jail. Many of us have played that Monopoly game, so you've seen this card over and over again. You ever park in the wrong spot and come back and your car is gone? You've had to go to get to the pound to pay a pretty hefty price. And if you're Pinocchio and you tell a lie, your nose grows. Your nose grows, is that right? That's right. We have some people who maybe are working in our government levels who should have long nose, but I won't comment any more on that. because I've learned over the years that that's a dangerous territory to venture into. Fools rush in, as they say, and so on. Now, when we add to this issue of fairness, we have to enclose the concept of free will and choice. And we start by affirming that one of the greatest gifts God has given to human beings is free will, which is the capacity to think and to choose. We are unique species in being able to think about alternatives in advance before deciding and acting. Also, we can change our minds once we've made a decision if we conclude that there is a preferred alternative to the one we choose. So here you have the thinking person, which is a universal representation of the way in which we all go into the future, making our decisions based upon alternatives. You can't see that sign quite clearly here, but it says something like this: I love being right so much that I change my mind when I'm wrong. To me, that's a wonderful saying. Change your mind and change the world. And here's one person, an unsung person by the name of Rosa Parks, who one day decided she wasn't going to do what? Sit at the back of the bus. She'd had it. No more sitting at the back of the bus. And basically, she started that one decision from that one person. She changed her mind about how she was going to do the simple act of transportation and share where she was going to sit on that piece of public transportation called bus. Brought about very significant ways changes that we identify with the civil rights movement. Now, when people have choices to make, they sometimes inflict pain on other people. So we have to talk about evil, pain, and suffering. Because of free will, we can make both good and bad choices, and some of them lead to evil. Now, by evil, we mean harming somebody intentionally with malice aforethought. And this can range from total or limited to total. So you see in the middle at the bottom an image of somebody punching somebody in the jaw. This is rather a limited form of evil. I don't recommend it to anybody, but when you compare it to the next one, it's quite mild compared to what? The Holocaust. And being in a concentration camp as a slave and working unto death for the Germans in order to build their Nazi war machine. That's total evil. Now, when we begin to get into the topic of evil, there is frequently made within the field of philosophy what's called a distinction between natural evil and moral evil. Moral evil is what we intentionally do to others and the pain and the suffering that that causes. And natural evil is what happens just by being a human being living in nature as a bodied being. Al and I do not make the distinction between natural and moral evil. We focus only on moral evil, because nature, we conclude, is not evil. Nature just is, and we are all part of it. We all are born. We are all born with different capacities and aptitudes and abilities, and we all go through life at a different pace, and so on and so forth, and we all suffer harm and pains along the way that are directly attributable to the natural world we live in. But when we experience those pains and suffering from nature, we don't say nature is suddenly evil. But we do when we harm each other and impose evil or harm or inflict harm or hurt on other people. So we focus only on moral evil and not on nature as a source of evil, even though it causes pain and suffering. All right? Because of our free will, we have intentions or purposes that lead specifically to outcome. And once we accept that God has given us the gift of free will, it is easy to take the next step. We act with intentionality, and as thoughtful persons, we engage in activities that are driven by purpose. We set goals and we pursue them. However, as we have all experienced, and this is a leftover from last week, the outcomes that we hope will occur might not be the ones that we intended. This has happened to us many times. So what you have up here is a little equation called disappointment, where your expectations are over reality. And here's a person, I've known many people like this, he has a PhD, and he's carrying a sign that says, I just finished 3 postdocs, I published 6 papers, and I will work for food. This is a person whose outcomes were inconsistent with his intentions, and if you're in an area where there are more PhDs than there are jobs, you may find yourself in a difficult position with regard to unemployment. Over here is a broken heart, and anybody who's ever been through a romance that didn't work out or involved themselves in a situation that ended in separating a relationship knows that the outcome is inconsistent with the intent. And over here is somebody who is tied to the bottle, alcoholism or addiction of some kind. Taking that first drink may not in fact lead to that problem, but the intended outcome for some people in the realm of alcoholism is a direct result of that intention. And to be addicted to alcohol or any substance is not something that addicts intended when they started that trip down that road. So that's kind of how we think about it. Now, if you tie together intentions with outcome, there are 4 possibilities. And this is really what Paul was getting to, although he didn't say it in the same language. And it goes like this. Good intentions that lead to good outcomes, under A, we consider fair. Good intentions that lead to bad outcomes, we consider to be unfair or unjust. Bad intentions that lead to bad outcomes, we consider fair. And then bad intentions that lead to good outcomes, we consider unfair. There are all kinds of examples. There is a 2-hour discussion associated with these 4 possibilities. But this is the way we experience life. We experience life with good intentions and bad outcomes. Bad outcomes and good intentions. It cuts 4 different ways. Now, in other words, another way to say that is this. When good things happen to good people, we consider it fair. When bad things happen to good people, we consider it unfair. Think of all the random events that have occurred in the last 2 or 3 years with regards to shootings in high schools, bridges falling on top of people, being in the wrong place at the wrong time over and over again, and these are bad things that happen to good people. Rabbi Kushner wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He was dealing with it, and he had to develop a theological justification for doing it. We normally struggle with the question of bad things happening to good people, but when good things happen to good people, we don't struggle as much. We consider it to be the way life ought to be. And then also you can have bad things happening to bad people, which we consider to be a just due or a desert that that person has gotten, a fair way to be treated. And then also good things can happen to bad people as well. There are some people in a relationship who are intentionally mean-spirited, who end that relationship and take everything out of it they can and leave other people in that relationship in a condition of distress. And that is not an unusual accomplishment where some people can have good outcomes, whether you like that outcome or not, that are associated with bad behaviors. Now, it is because of these 4 possibilities that we conclude this. Life is not fair. Life is simply not fair. But what we really mean by this is that life is not consistently fair. There are times when life is fair, when good things happen to good people. There's little 2 kids at the bottom. One kid has what? A bigger piece of cake than the other one. This little kid over here doesn't have a very happy look on his face because for him, life is what? Not fair. We know that some people are born under conditions over here where just being a single individual outweighs the life conditions of other people. And I always say the most important thing that you can do in your life is choose your own parents. And it's better to be born with the name of Walton Kennedy Rockefeller than it probably is with McFall. Why? Because you get a different start in life. Very, very different start in life. the whole lecture, for example, when the Kennedy child is born, somebody puts $1 million in the bank for them. And it accumulates progressively. They don't touch it until they're 21 or 22 years old. And by the time they get access to that money, there is so much in the principal that they literally can live off the interest without having to, as most of us do every morning, go to work. Now, that's the way to come into the world, if that's the family you choose to be born in, because it will be taken care of for you. That's very different than being the sixth sibling in a sharecropper family on the Delta of Mississippi back in the day, and so on. Very different set of life chances. Life is not consistently fair. So the question is fairness, unfairness, and randomness. Given both the consistencies and the inconsistencies that exist in the air of fairness, we conclude that a great deal of what happens to us is the result of randomness. What occurs in our lives and the lives of others is not only inconsistent, but it's unpredictably inconsistent. Think if your name, if you were born into the family in England and you had a spouse or a sibling or a son named Harry or William, right? You chose your parents very well, because for the rest of your life, you will be part of that royal family. And suddenly along comes a young woman named Megan, and she falls in love with Harry. And if I read it all right, I think they're about to get married, if I'm not mistaken about that. And that is the luck of the draw. That is the inconsistency. You take Rabbi Kushner's child, who had the disease of advanced aging, whose child died when he was 14 years old, and he looked like he was 75. He was simply born with that. But we don't consider that evil. We consider that just being part of nature. And we will do what we can in the field of medicine one day to try to correct that genetic deficiency. So life is unpredictably inconsistent. And as a result, we are simply left to wonder why. Where does God fit into this picture? This is especially so when inconsistencies result from evil, that is, the intentional harm and suffering that some people impose on others. Now, the Christian answer to this, why is life so inconsistent and where does God fit into the picture, usually takes two forms. One is the form of Job. The Job, as a book in the Old Testament, is one of the most insightful of all books. And you really, Job struggles with why he as a good, righteous person must suffer what he suffers. He doesn't know if God makes a deal with the devil, but that's just part of the story. And at the end, God answers him out of the whirlwind in chapter 38. Where were you when I created the heavens and the earth? Who are you to tell me, God, how I should run the universe? I am, after all, God, and you are not. So Job finally, after about four chapters of God berating Job for his theology of, if I'm a good person, I should be rewarded, and life isn't really like that, finally concedes to be faithful, no matter what happens in life. The other alternative is to take a look at what are called the three perfections of God. And it goes something like this. The three perfections are that God is all-loving, all-powerful, and all-knowing. And here is the story. If God is all-loving, why does evil even exist? If God is all-powerful, why doesn't God eliminate evil? And if God is all-knowing, why doesn't God stop evil where God knows it exists? Now, if you can answer that question, write a book really fast. But there are Christian answers to that question based upon the idea of free will. And here's how it goes. God knows us better than we know ourselves. And God does not predetermine how we will act, but God knows how we will act. And when we act, we must take responsibility for our behaviors. That's the first. God is all-knowing. But also, God forgives us when we act wrongly because we have free will and we can make choices and we fall short all the time. And the one constant in the universe is God's forgiving love. And if we go to God in repentance, genuine repentance, and with a contrite heart, God is forgiving, therefore God is loving. The most difficult one is God is all-powerful. But the assumption here is this: God will allow evil to exist only for a certain period of time, and then God will intervene to stop it. That is, ultimately, God's will prevail. Now, the difficulty here is the problem of violence. And the one question I think is real worth exploring, but we can't do it here, is simply this: does God use violence to stop violence? Does God use a lesser violence to stop a really horrendous violence? Think of the Second World War. Think of the tremendous carnage that resulted from that as one Axis power came up against Allied powers, and the result was violence on both sides. Think of our own Civil War in the United States, which resulted in massive violence for keeping the nation together and ultimately destroying the institution of slavery. Does God use violence to destroy violence? This is a topic worth discussion. Alas, but not today. Okay? So, free will, we know all about this, but it's very tricky, and it is very clear that people who become atheists, one of the main stumbling blocks for religious belief is the existence of evil. How can a loving, powerful, and knowledgeable God allow for so much evil to exist? And then when you raise the issue of, well, God has given us the gift of free will, then the question becomes, is there a point in the level of evil where somehow goodwill itself should be modified? And that is an interesting discussion in and of itself, which we are not going to resolve here. But it's one of the questions that's out there all the time, that's debated whenever these issues come up in a course on moral philosophy. All right, now, here is the way Al and I approach this problem. How do we resolve the relationship of God to the unpredictable inconsistencies in life where intentions and outcomes can go four different ways, and one of the outcomes can be evil, even horrendous evil? And we approach this from the perspective of what we call dimensionality. And here's how it works. Due to the limitations of finite human existence, we humans live in only four dimensions that include time and space. And space is height, width, and depth. And all of our earthly experiences are included within these four dimensions. The next question we ask is, are there any extra dimensions out there through which God would work? And here's what we turn to. Is there any evidence in science that would suggest there might be more than four dimensions associated with the experience that we have as human beings? And the answer seems to be yes. There's new research on the brain that suggests that the brain stores information in not just four dimensions, but as many as 11 dimensions that we have access to. There are also other evidences of what we call multidimensionality, and it's the mystical experience. And this experience has been well documented in the writings of William James, who's on the left. You all recognize the middle photo, and that's the photo or the sketch of the Buddha. And the one on the right is someone you may or may not have heard of. It's called Teresa of Avila, who's a 16th century Christian female mystic who has gone deep into the mystical experience and outlines a program that can be followed to experience it through prayer. Also, we get a sense of some extra dimensionality in near-death experiences. And they have most recently been popularized by Eben Alexander, called Proof of Heaven. Anybody in here read that book? A lot of people have read The Proof of Heaven, which is an attempt to talk about a dimensionality that is beyond the normal four dimensions that we operate in. And of course, anybody who's ever had a near-death experience, they're happen all over the world. And many people will have visions of themselves doing what? Literally leaving their bodies. That one graphic that you see on the lower right is a something, spirit, or whatever you want to call it, that's left the body, hovers up near the ceiling or in the corner of the room and looks back on his or her own body to see what's happening. Those near-death experiences, how often do they happen? They happen often enough and in a variety of contexts to suggest that something is going on here in a dimension that is beyond the four dimensions that we normally experience. So, here's what we conclude. We're beginning to conclude. Randomness and complexity. Our minds are the sieves that filter out, William James called it the buzzin' bloomin' confusion. A phrase I like very much in life. Life is just too complex for our finite minds to grasp it all, including unfairness. And there are many factors that comprise this complexity, which last week we called noise, and can be combined with many potential ways or signals of combining. So what you see down here is the tree of life. And anybody who studied the evolution of life on Earth knows that species just popped out. They just seem to have come out of nowhere. And the case is frequently made is that God is creating new species as we go along. But there's a different scientific and naturalistic interpretation to that, and that's this. Think of yourself as this little red dot right here in the middle of the scattergram on the left. This is the color scattergram, consists of the colors of the rainbow. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet. Now imagine yourself, this really is all black and white. Think of it as black and white. You are here and you are here. Your brain and my brain can only cover few of the factors that surround our heads, but outside of us are all of these other factors, and they can combine in ways that we are completely unaware of. So when a new species occurs, you say, where did that come from? It came from a combination or an unknowable combination at that point in time of factors that we simply do not have access to conceptually or cognitively. That's how complex life is. So it doesn't require necessarily a supernatural explanation, although that's possible, but it can be explained strictly in terms of naturalistic phenomenon and the complexities of the world that surround us. It's like trying to predict the weather a month in advance. It's so complex that it's very difficult, near to impossible, to make that prediction because the system is changing in such complex ways that we do not understand, and that is life. Now, the question is, how does God relate to this complexity? And here's where we go. This is our final conclusion, and this is the last sentence in the book. So if you haven't gotten that far and you bought the book, you can anticipate what the last sentence will be, and it's this. Thus, while there remains much we cannot explain and probably never will, we are confident in our conclusion that it is God, the intelligent creator who is working actively within the randomness that is an inherent part of our structured universe. So if you move your eyes from the left to the right of those graphics, this is God at work in the universe as a whole from the beginning. In the lilies of the field that never what? Reap nor toil, and yet Solomon in all of his glory is not arrayed as one of these. That comes right from Jesus. But go from the universe, this mighty force, down to the lily that you can crush in your hand. And of course, the love that moves through the family, which is the other one. And wherever peace and love and justice occur in the world, the assumption is that God is at work. And one final graphic. And that's this. I leave you with this thought. The Jesus event was a random event. It was unpredictable, at least from the human side. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Where does that saying come from? Right out of the Bible. Because all the action was supposed to happen not up there in the Galilee, which was the hick town area of ancient Judea. It was supposed to happen where? Down in Jerusalem. That's exactly right. And out of Nazareth, at age 30, comes a baptized Jewish young man who starts his own movement, and ultimately, after a year or two, we're really not quite sure how long his movement was, he was eliminated. He was what? Never wrote anything down, never took a picture of a selfie of himself and circulated it to his 12 disciples. And for all intents and purposes, the movement he developed scattered after a very short period of time and eventually came back together. And 3 years later, this rabbi called Saul had this enormous experience where? On the Damascus Road. And he became the first great missionary of Christianity, and many of the books, including the book of Romans, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, and so on, came from his pen, and he never knew who Jesus was, and he never met him, and he started out persecuting him. That's randomness. Now, it might not have been randomness to God, but those of us who are on the human side of the random, or of the on the human side of the divine human encounter, don't know what's going on inside God's head. And when something happens that we don't understand, it is entirely possible, going back to this others, that we are confident that it is the intelligent creator we call God who is working through this randomness. And there is so much randomness that has happened in the history of Christianity that we can say, even though we can't grasp it or understand it, our faith tells us that somehow in the midst of that, even though good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people, bad things, and so on. Those four different ways in which intentions and outcomes can be combined in ways that we don't fully understand. Our faith tells us that in the midst of all of that, God is at work. And when we get finally to the world, the lower right-hand signal here, or graphic, the lower right hand in the corner, indicates that Christianity, which was once relatively isolated from the other religions and cultures of the world, no longer is. We are now part of a global village where one-third of the world's people who are Christians are interacting with two-thirds of the world's people who are not. So not only do Christians within this one-third of the world's people, which is 2.3 billion people or so, work within the context of the Christian message, but increasingly Christians are working within the context of the religious messages from other religions, so that when we work together, ultimately in the long run, hopefully, as God is working in the midst of all of this, the world will become a better place for all to live. Questions? Yes, sir. What is it? Somebody say, duh. Was as clear as mud? You leave with more questions than are answered, right? This is good, because there's an opportunity in the future to come back and do some more talking. Yes, sir.
So you said that, you kind of posed it as much of this is a way to understand randomness and unfairness in terms of, or in relation to God's perfection. Is that correct?
Well, the way I would see it is unfairness. When we say unfairness, that's unfairness from the human side.
Yeah.
We want everything to be consistent, but it's not.
But I was going to ask, is there a philosophical justification for the idea of God's perfection, or is that more kind of wishful thinking?
No, not necessarily. It's a philosophical question that's been around from the time of the Greeks. And anytime somebody starts working on the issue of the nature of God, God is ultimately assumed to be the most ultimate reality in the universe beyond which there is nothing greater. And therefore it is not difficult to take the next step to think that God is therefore the most loving force in the universe, the more powerful force in the universe, and also the most knowledgeable force. These are called the omnis, omniscient, omnipotent, and so on and so forth. But the better way to say it is God is all-loving. But the quandary is, how does an all-loving God who's all-powerful and all-knowing allow for evil to exist? And the only way to get to that question is through the issue of free will. Now, there was a philosopher by the name of Leibniz who said, God allows only so much evil in the world and no more. God will allow us to commit evil to the extent that we express our free will, and God will permit that. But ultimately, God will intervene into that evil and somehow stop it, even if it involves the use of violence. And for those of us who come out of a religion where we define Christ as the Prince of Peace and so on and so forth, the question is, how does God work in this large structure of history where good and evil are working themselves out, and where force gets put up against force, even to the extent of having to pick up the sword and getting blood on the hand in order to stop evils from occurring, even in the process of doing so, we might have to commit some ourselves. That is an enormous quandary. And Abraham Lincoln struggled with this question too. And his final response was really this: God's justice will prevail, even if it does involve the war against the North and the South. God's justice ultimately will prevail, and we are paying the price in our civil war for the massive injustices that are built into the system of slavery. Somebody has to pay the price, says Abraham Lincoln, and the Civil War was part of that price. That was his perspective. And he was the only president in the history of the country whose entire presidency was spent during a period of war. The entire time he became president was during the period of the Civil War. And yet he saw God's hand in the midst of that and ended thinking, we're going to come out of this as a better and more moral nation. Yes?
Doesn't this apply to the environment? If we're not good stewards of God's environment, that...
If we're not good stewards of God's environment, that's a very good issue. God has given us the free will to destroy ourselves with. Mm-hmm. That's how much God loves us. We can choose to go to hell. We can make choices that will take us into our own self-destruction, and we do it all the time. And one of them is the environment. The only question is, when God created the world, God pronounced it good. Will God allow us, human beings, taking your example as the environment, ultimately to destroy the creation which God brought into existence as through goodness? The only question is, will God intervene at some point to stop it? And the answer to that is, we don't know. It's like, for example, I've had discussions of people who talked about the Holocaust. And there's a whole group of Jewish, young Jewish people who call themselves secular Jews that cannot believe in God, even though they celebrate the Jewish holidays. And the reason they can't believe in God is because of the Holocaust, because of the evil. And they ask themselves, what did we do so horribly that we deserved this? I can't believe in such a God. And the theological answer to that is simply, God will do it on God's own timetable. And like Paul Rasmussen said this morning, we want it done on whose timetable?
Ours.
But our timetable is not necessarily God's timetable. And when evil persists, we say, stop it. And yet, we must wait upon the Lord, finally, in the last analysis, in order for the actions that we take to bring about a positive result that will end spoiling the environment, possibly, or engaging in evil activities that produce harm on others. Yes, sir, Charles.
The position that God knows what we're going to do ahead of time has a problem with me, because however the universe turns out, whatever we do is what he already knew. There's an alternative to that, to say, God, if he's all-powerful, could limit his pre-knowledge and give us free will.
The answer is correct. Yes, yes, yes. The answer that God foreknows what we're going to do but doesn't determine it is a response to predestination, that God determines what we're going to do. Now, if God gives us free will, then God does not necessarily know how we're going to choose. That's a big philosophical argument that's gone on for a long period of time, is that God doesn't know what I'm going to do this afternoon because I haven't made my decisions yet. And somebody who comes out of a more predestination argument would say, no, God knows what you're going to do, but you're going to be responsible for it. So how do it involves a dilemma that's almost irresolvable.
Except if you, as a follow-on, if he's all-powerful, he could limit his free will.
That's possible, too. God could limit God's own free will. That is correct. But then the issue is, can human beings stop, ultimately, God's intentions in the universe? And most theologians would say no to that. Human beings do not ultimately have the capacity to trump God, that ultimately God will prevail. No matter how much evil human beings do, God will eventually intervene to stop it. It's a terrific problem, but we have to raise it in the context of fairness and trying to understand how God relates to the unpredictable inconsistencies of life. Okay, I usually go boy, girl, so you'll be the next boy, and I've got, can you give me 2 more minutes? Yes, question.
So, I don't know if it was the previous slide or the next slide, whatever. Is your premise when you say that God is at work in the randomness, the idea that it's all part of God's plan, or is it something different than that, that God is reactionary at work in the randomness?
Both. It's both. I think that's a really good question. The question one is what happens in randomness part of God's plan, or does God react to how we react to randomness? That's the real good question. And the answer is that's probably not solvable. But what usually comes out of this in the terms of the life of faith is something like this. God's ways are not our ways. And if we try to make God's ways our ways by answering whether God works through randomness or whether reacts to randomness as we react to it, is one of those issues that we as human beings from our side of the divine human encounter don't have access to.
And the second part of that, and this kind of goes with the previous question, but this idea of, God will eventually intervene, not on our timetable, it almost seems like a license for humans to throw our hands up and say it's not my problem.
That's
right?
Exactly correct. That's one of the responses.
And that is inherently unsatisfying. God works through us.
That's correct.
And so if there is evil in this world,
that's
if
correct.
There is somebody who doesn't have food, if there is somebody being oppressed, it is not for us to say God will solve this when it gets bad enough and it's not my problem.
That's absolutely.
We have to jump in.
And
we are the people that solve it.
You have the will to say, I'm not getting involved in this. It's God's problem, not mine. That's your choice. And God will give you the will and the choice not to become involved in evils that other people, in fact, might perpetuate. But at some point, God, the assumption is, will intervene in that process and stop it. And that's the way that God will choose, even though we may not be able to understand how that happens. And there will be some people who will decide to become involved in that evil situation, even though others do not. And those people who do become involved may be the ones who resolve it. But you always have the choice to say, I'm in or I'm out. No matter what's going on in the world, one can decide whether to be a part of it or not. But that's a correct observation. In other words, what we're doing here is we are really raising questions that in some sense can't finally be satisfactorily answered to our heads. And therefore, maybe God's ways aren't our ways, and maybe Job was right. No matter what happens to us, we should remain faithful and be as righteous as we possibly can in the process of trying to be faithful without understanding and resolving all the great mysteries of life. And you've raised one of them very well. One final question, I think. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
And then we're ready to go, because if you start drifting out, there may only be 2 or 3 of us left by the time we get all the questions answered. One final comment, sir. That's correct. We'll leave it on that note. It says we are always tempted to want to create God in our own image. I think the reason for this is because we want God's ways to, in some sense, be our ways. As we struggle for our own consistency and faith and beliefs, when good things happen to us, do we think that's a gift from God? When bad things happen to us, we say, why me, God? And when bad people benefit, we say, why the heck are they benefiting? And that's going to happen in the future. That's going to continue to happen because God has given us the gift of free will. And whether God will eventually cut that off at some point without saying, I'll let you go so far and no farther, like Leibniz said, is one of the questions that's difficult to ask. But you are correct. We as human beings want to create God to some extent in our own images. And when that doesn't happen, we ask, why? Thank you all very much.